Podo. You're listening to The Election Tricycle with Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin and Rohan Venkat.
Hello and welcome to The Election Tricycle, a podcast in which we talk about the elections in 2024 in India, the USA and the UK and some other places around the world as well. And we explore connections and differences between them. I'm Tom Hamilton in London, and I'm joined by Rohan Venkat in Cairo, I think.
Hello, yes, in Cairo.
And Emily in Washington or New York? Washington this week.
In Washington, D.C., yes.
As every week.
As every week.
And this week we're going to be focusing in particular on Israel's war in Gaza and how that is impacting on domestic politics in our three countries. So I think we're going to start with Emily. Take it away. How is Gaza affecting the US election in particular? How's it affecting how Joe Biden is going down with Democrats?
Well, we actually have, I'm glad we're having this conversation this week because yesterday was the primary in Michigan. And I have sort of alluded to on previous episodes of this podcast that Michigan is one of the states where Biden is probably going to face difficulty because of his position on Israel's war against Hamas and Gaza. And we got a taste of that last night. So basically, there was a campaign in Michigan for voters to vote uncommitted in the Democratic primary as a way to make their voices heard, as a way to tell the Democratic Party and the Biden team, we want you to change your position on Gaza. We want you to stop funding this war. We want you to stop blocking resolutions at the UN. You need to change your direction on this. They won about 100,000 votes, actually a little over 100,000 votes for uncommitted. Obviously, right away, people who are sympathetic to that message claim that this was a major coup, and sort of Democratic Party loyalists said this isn't really anything at all, actually. I think, as usual, the truth is somewhere in between. They definitely mobilized for this campaign. It definitely did work to get people talking about this, and I think it did signify that Biden is going to have trouble with Arab American population. If you looked at where the uncommitted votes came in, it was areas of Michigan that have large Arab American populations, but also the county that has University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, which means it has a lot of young people, right? Now, young people are not only voting in Michigan. And by the way, when we say young voters are sympathetic to this position, I want to stress that that includes young Jewish voters, right? You know, at the beginning of this war, there was a poll from the Jewish Electorate Institute that said that it was something like 80% of Democrats overall backed Biden's policy. When you looked at Jews under 35, that number dropped to about 50%. And this was back months ago. Just for listeners to have some context here, if you're not familiar with me or with my work, my second book is on American Jewish politics and identities. And I write often as a journalist on American Jewish politics and sort of divisions, debates, discussions between American Jews and American Jewish institutions, and also between those institutions and the rest of American politics. So not to be like, I know of what I speak, but this is something I spend a lot of time thinking about and reporting on and writing about. The problem with this strategy for Biden in terms of domestic politics was really sort of clear from the beginning in that on October 7th, so on the day of this horrific attack by Hamas, Biden, of course, you know, a full-throated support of Israel, flew to Israel, you know, embraced Netanyahu, who historically was quite close to Trump, but embraced Netanyahu. You know, Biden, he's an old school Democratic politician on this issue and is a staunch supporter for Israel and has been his whole career. Fine. But we should also say that from the very beginning, the Israeli defense minister, right at the start, said, we're not going to let food or water or electricity in. Right. So from the very beginning, it was clear that at least some members of the Israeli government were going to call for collective punishment and that Biden's support for Israel and Biden's stated support for rule of law and the international order and liberal democracy and human rights and all of these things that we talked about last week, that these two things were going to come to a head because of how Israel was itself saying it wanted to conduct this war. And I think as time has gone on, that's become clearer as the death toll in Gaza has gone up, as Israeli politicians have continued to make statements that are extremely dehumanizing toward Palestinians, as Israel has gone back and forth with Biden as to whether or not to allow aid into the country. We should also say that Biden and Netanyahu are at different aims here, right? Biden does not want this to continue, does not want this to be the major political story. Well, Netanyahu has no reason to want this war to end because he knows that his voters and the Israelis may well want him out after the war, right? He put together a very contentious coalition. This coalition then ignored reports that an attack like this was coming. And by the way, just as there are protests here against Biden, there are protests in Israel against Netanyahu from families of the hostages, from people who, you know, from people who don't like how he's conducting the war or how he's treated those who have suffered most in Israel. So I think Biden and Netanyahu are at odds. I think that, you know, the United States will say, or the Biden administration will say, we want this to lead to a two-state solution. Netanyahu will come out and say, we don't, there's never going to be a Palestinian state. I recently asked National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan about this at an event. I said, you know, you're saying that this is going to lead to two states. They are saying very clearly and in public that that's never going to happen. So you're supporting the war with the condition that this is the end goal. They're saying that end goal is not achievable. Like, what do you, and it was sort of, oh, we continue to have conversations with their interlocutors. The American vote in public sees all this. Right. I mean, not everybody, but like the people who are aware of foreign policy, who feel passionately about this issue, which is many people. There's just one other thing I want to say before I end my soliloquy, which is that the New York Times this past weekend had a story saying that if Biden changes his approach, that in order to sort of appeal to younger voters or Muslim voters or Arab American voters, that risks alienating Jewish voters. It definitely does risk alienating some Jewish voters. I'm not denying that. But I also think that we should note that recent polling from the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, you know, an institute that envisions an America where Muslims are thriving and equal, per their website. By their polling, a majority of Jewish Democrats, that's 54%, support a ceasefire. And when you go to Jews in America overall, that goes to 50%. So I think to sort of pit this as like Muslims want this, Jewish Americans want this, is I think kind of misleading. Right. I think there are definitely Jewish institutions that do not want Biden to change his approach and who will say that American Jews don't want him to change his approach. But I think that if you scratch beneath the surface, you can see sort of in terms of ideology, in terms of denomination, in terms of age, it's a more complicated picture. You know, and I finally just want to say, like, the Listen to Michigan sort of uncommitted campaign put out a statement and said, we don't want a Trump presidency, but Biden has put Netanyahu ahead of American democracy. We cannot afford to pay the bill for disregarding Palestinian lives should it come due in November. And I think this gets to the core of it for people, which is that if you look at the Trump presidency, he was terrible on this issue, right? Like, he cut aid to Palestinians. He closed the consulate. He moved the embassy. He set in motion this policy of trying to normalize Israeli relations to other states in the region, ignoring Palestinians, right? We'll take care of that later or never. And I think if you look at his relationship to Netanyahu and other sort of authoritarians, real and aspiring, there's very little to suggest that he would stand up to him. But for people who have family in Gaza, right, or in the West Bank, or who are themselves Palestinian, who are themselves Muslim, like, that's not enough, right, to say, okay, I'm going to back the person who's sending arms. So that's where the Democratic Party is right now, I think.
I had a couple of questions about that. One is, obviously, for what it's worth, Biden, unsurprisingly, still won the Michigan primary.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is of no surprise to anybody, but it's worth just mentioning. Trump also won his Michigan primary, again, comfortably, but by a bit less. And people are entitled to vote whatever they want in a primary, but they will often come back to vote for the candidate they didn't support in the primary in the general. How much of a threat to Biden in the long term is this sort of protest vote? How many of these voters will stay away, not vote at all, maybe vote green, maybe see who else is out there?
Yeah, I think this is the real question. I think the Jewish Democratic Council for America came out last night and said, well, we understand, like, in a primary, you're going to vote uncommitted, but we're sure the Democrats will come out and support Biden in November. And you had some very online progressives say, like, no, that's not what we're saying, right? And I think the answer is mixed. I think some people will come November, say, okay, I'm voting for Biden. You know, I did my protest primary vote, now I'm going to support Biden. And some will stay home. And you're absolutely right to point out that Trump actually had a tougher fight in Michigan than Biden did, although both won their primaries.
To be fair, I mean, Trump was fighting against an actual person.
Right. But I think in both cases, it's like, we talked about this once, where like with Biden, you always imagine what does sort of like the average American voter think. And with Trump, it's what is the most extreme member of the party going to think. But there are nominal Republicans who also don't like Trump, who could, what's the song, we're fighting the battle of who could care less? Like, that's sort of what we saw in Michigan, right? Like who will be less popular? Whose voters will be less enthused in November? Okay, other guy wins. But you had another question, Tom.
Yeah, the other one was the sort of counterfactual question, which you partly touched on, but I want to go wider than just the Jewish voters question, which is, suppose Biden either had from the start said maybe something boilerplate about this is an atrocity and Israel has the right to defend itself, but mustn't do all these things, and was really sort of, in a way that we've not really seen an American president do, but in principle, you could take a much more hostile to Israel line. If he'd done that, would he really be in a better position now than he is, given all the implications of that position, not just for Jewish voters, but for wider voters who are just interested in foreign policy, national security?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to say in part because at the very beginning, some were saying, well, it's the bear hug in public and sort of berate in private, and that was going to be a more effective stance to sort of allow Israel to respond, but also sort of coax it into respecting international law. But we don't actually know if that, like, who would be lost from the coalition if Biden had done that. I think getting what we're sort of dancing around is that Biden won in 2020 with a particular coalition. And even though he won comfortably in the popular vote, that doesn't matter, right? What matters is the electoral college, the electoral vote. And there he won pretty narrowly with this coalition. And sort of whatever he does, it risks the coalition, right? But what we're seeing right now is that what he is doing is hurting him with Arab American voters, Muslim American voters, and younger voters, or at least for, you know, the past, 20 years have been, and younger voters for longer have been Democratic votes.
There was this Ezra Klein opinion piece a couple of weeks ago, giving the idea that Biden should step down at some point and there should be a managed convention for another candidate to come up from the Democratic side. Now, we can put aside, I'd love to hear what you think about this in general, but we put aside the mechanics of this. One of the ideas was that a different Democratic ticket might be more easier to deal with the legacy of the Gaza war on this. The question that turned up for me was, are there Democrats out there who have presidential ambitions, if not this time, you know, a subsequent election, who have taken a strong line or even a milder line than Biden out there? Are there people who can credibly say that they're not doing the same thing as Biden in how they speak in about this war?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders, who's not running and who has not called for a ceasefire, but has called for conditioning humanitarian aid. There are definitely Democrats, they're in a minority, but who take a different position in Congress, but they're not running for president. And I think more broadly, I think the fact is that the quote unquote person who's done best against Biden in these primaries is uncommitted, right? Like is no person. And I think that speaks to part of the problem that Democrats had this cycle is like, okay, Biden's not popular, sort of neither is anybody else. Like a protest vote is not actually a candidate.
But isn't that an incumbency thing? If you want to be president in 4-8 years time and you're an ambitious Democrat, you don't go this time.
Okay. Yes, it is. But also I think looking at the field, I don't think that there was a clear, like, yes, this is the person people are going to get behind. And in fact, like, you know, somebody that people talk about as perhaps running one day is Gretchen Whitmer, who's the governor of Michigan, disappointed progressives by coming out and saying, like, don't vote uncommitted, right? So, you know, there were candidates that people floated who maybe would have taken a tougher line against Israel, who I don't think would have, like, some, there was an essay going around at one point about Andy Levin, who was a congressman, but he lost his primary for Congress. You know what I mean? Like, that's not a person who's necessarily going to be able to win the nomination, much less the presidency. Okay. But now that I've spoken about American politics for half of our allotted main time, I did want to ask, you know, I guess I'll start with this, you know, in the United States, the very definition of anti-Semitism is contested. And I think one thing that Democrats have had to, maybe they don't have to, but they've kept in mind is that criticism of Israel is pounced on as anti-Semitic by the Republican Party. Meanwhile, you have Republicans who, you know, Elise Stefanik, congresswoman from New York, went viral for her tough questioning of the presidents of various universities for not being tough enough of anti-Semitism. Elise, you pushed replacement theory, which is an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that we have literally seen replicated in manifestos of violent shooters. So like, I don't want to hear what a good friend you are to the Jews, but there she is taking a photo with the president of Israel, you know, after this congressional hearing. So the sort of who is the better friend, which party is the better friend for Israel? Does that actually mean that you're not an anti-Semite, right? What is the relationship between support for Israel and anti-Semitism? All of this is very live in American politics. And Tom, I was curious, I know it is in the UK too, but in different ways. And I was curious to hear how that's showing up in this election cycle.
Yeah, I think it plays in some ways that are similar in the UK and some ways that are different. I think one of the really important similarities is that this is much more of an issue for the mainstream left of centre party than for the mainstream right of centre party in terms of causing it internal angst and internal trouble. And some of that is structural. Some of it is about the recent history of the Labour Party and its attitude and perceived attitude and the attitude certainly of some people in it towards both Jews and Israel as separate but connected entities. So those things are really sort of critical to the debate. And actually, it's worth saying that some of the problem stems from a really quite significant misstep by Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, really early on. And we can cover all of those, but it's also just worth saying that although it's a really important issue in the world, and it's an important issue in public debate, it doesn't feel like a very significant election issue in a way that it might be in some other countries. So there is an overlap in a very similar sort of coalition to the one that you were talking about in relation to Biden in Michigan of, I guess, a combination of younger voters, lefter voters, Muslim voters, I think have a particular interest in this issue and are particularly nervous about Labour's position. But there are questions about how big that group is and particularly about how significant that group is in a world in which Labour is as far ahead as it is. You know, we at the moment don't have an election that's anything like as tight as the one that that you have in the US. The big misstep that I think is really important and has sort of coloured Labour's attitude to this whole conflict came 2 or 3 days after the October the 7th atrocity, when Keir Starmer was being questioned about this on LBC, which is a British radio station, and was being asked about Israel's, he basically conflated two issues in a really damaging way. So he's being asked about Israel's generic right to self-defense, which he said Israel has a right to self-defense. And you want to say that without necessarily giving them a blank check for, these are my words, not his, but you want to say that without endorsing a blank check for any particular behavior. But the right to self-defense is really important, and an atrocity had just happened, and he wanted to stand on that side of that divide. And he was asked about Israel, you mentioned this earlier, Emily, cutting off power and water in Gaza. And I think this was a misspeaking, but nevertheless, he said, Israel absolutely does have that right. Now, he was probably talking about the broader self-defense question, but for days, Labour's press team doubled down and said, yes, he meant what he said. Israel does have the right to withhold power and water from Gaza, and then stepped back and said, okay, no, not that. He slightly misheard the question. That wasn't the point. Now, clearly, that was not a sensible thing to say. And in a world in which a lot of people, both within the Labour Party and on the broader left, are really concerned about how Israel responds, it was both wrong in principle and quite a dangerous thing to say. And there are reasons why he didn't row back, which again are to do with Labour's recent history. So as you'll know, Labour had a real problem. Well, I think it had a real problem, but it also had a media perceived problem around anti-Semitism, around its previous leadership and some of the attitudes that Jeremy Corbyn and people around him had towards Israel, which manifested in some of the ways in which they talked about Jews more generally. And Starmer has wanted to step away from that. He really has changed things quite significantly in the Labour Party in terms of how those are dealt with, in terms of disciplinary processes and so on. They talk about the issue in very different ways. Many of the people who were involved at senior levels of the Labour Party then are no longer involved now. But that has affected how they've been able to talk about Israel and how they've wanted to talk about Israel. And I think it's slightly limited some of the ways in which they've wanted to be critical of Israel. At the same time, it's really clear that anti-Semitism in the Labour Party hasn't completely gone away. We can see that. We talked the other week about the Rochdale by-election and the Labour candidate there, who, by the way, was not a Corbynite by any means, spouting anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about Israel deliberately allowing October the 7th in order to create a pretext to go into Gaza. He is no longer the Labour candidate there, but clearly there is an undercurrent of that on the broader left that Starmer is desperately trying to distance himself from. And although, as I say, this isn't a major electoral issue in general, that probably won't, you know, if polls stay as they are, Labour will win the election quite comfortably. There are specific places where it could have an impact, which are, broadly speaking, areas where there is significant green strength in a lot of young people and areas where there is a really significant Muslim vote. Now, I think it's probably overstated to say that it's going to lead to Labour losing in either of those categories, but it probably will knock the top off their vote in places like that, that Labour and particular Labour candidates are really worried about. I think the other dimension of what's happened in the UK is, as you would expect, been a lot of demonstrations, sort of pro-Palestine demonstrations going on. Notably in London, every week or two since October the 7th, that has been going on, which are predominantly peaceful and predominantly sensible. But as you always get at these protests, there is an undercurrent. You know, there really are anti-Semitic slogans that get shouted, anti-Semitic posters that get shown. The other week, someone projected the words "from the river to the sea" on the side of Parliament, which, as you will know, is perceived as an anti-Semitic slogan by at least some of the people who witness it. And ministers were very critical of that. There's a lot of media criticism of that. Where that has then led to is we haven't just seen manifestations of anti-Semitism in the UK, but also manifestations of Islamophobia or anti-Muslim hatred in the UK. Anti-Semitism on the right is not really a significant issue in the UK at the moment. It is on the far right, but the far right is small. There are exceptions to that. So notably, Liz Truss last week went to, is it CPAC?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
And was with Steve Bannon on a platform that she shouldn't have been on a platform with Steve Bannon at all. Steve Bannon praised Tommy Robinson, who is a notorious far-right activist in the UK, and called him a hero. Liz Truss didn't push back. She absolutely should have done. Liz Truss is not a far-right figure. She's a problematic figure in various ways, but she just is not a far-right figure. But that is not something that we really see in the UK. Right-wing anti-Islamism, of the conflation of Islamists and Muslims more widely, really is an issue. And that's really come to the head this week with an MP that we spoke about last week, actually, briefly, Lee Anderson, a Tory MP, describing, basically saying that the reason why some of the anti-Semitism in protests in London has not been properly picked up is that London Mayor Sadiq Khan, who is, of course, as you can tell from his name, a Muslim, is basically being controlled by his Islamist mates. I mean, that is, as far as I can see, just quite unequivocally and clearly a racist statement. And yet, although he's been suspended, Tory MPs in general, Tory ministers, have been unable to say what was wrong with what he said, because there's clearly a lot of support for him within the broader Conservative Party. So although he's lost the Tory whip, there are real worries on the right that he might defect to the Reform Party, he might go somewhere else. There has not been the level of condemnation of what for me is an overtly racist statement that you would have expected to see. So right-wing anti-Islamism or anti-Muslim sentiment is not a new thing, but that too is a consequence of what's going on in Gaza in terms of its prominence.
Yeah, I think, and I think we should say, like, I mentioned anti-Semitism in American politics, which is real and should be discussed. But I think there is also so much Islamophobia in American politics that's not dissected or denounced in the same way at all. We had a congressman, I think last week, from Tennessee say, "Kill them all." He appeared to be speaking about Palestinians. He later came back and said, "Oh no, I meant Hamas." But like, that's if he had said that about any other group, I think it would have been a much bigger story than it was. And it sort of sometimes feels like it's still an acceptable hatred, particularly on the right, but not only on the right, in American politics. But Rohan, I wanted to bring you in here because I know that, like, look, I'll be honest, I think there are some politicians in the United States and some individuals in the United States who, you know, whose position on this issue are forged by their own Islamophobia. And I think it sounds like it's the same in the United Kingdom. And I was curious about, you know, the rights of Muslims is such a prominent issue in Indian politics that I was curious as to how it plays there.
I mean, that's exactly right for India as well. It's really, in some ways, Islamophobia or the presence of Muslims in political life that is governing the response to this, in that there isn't a huge political issue on this, simply because the question of minority rights has broadly been neutered by the current administration in India. What we're dealing with initially, right after October 7th happened, the Congress Party, which has historically been very pro-Palestine, did put out a resolution that didn't acknowledge the October 7th attack, and they spoke against Israel. But then there was a lot of coverage of what was happening within the Congress Party and criticism of it. And a lot of this gets refracted on the Hindu-Muslim question within India, trying to project that on the Jewish-Muslim question within Israel. But because the BJP has sought to portray Hindus as the rightful place of Indian democracy, the rest of parties are sort of just circling around this. And so Indian politics has become about who can appeal to the majority as best as possible. And so actually, the Israel-Palestine war, while having a little bit here and there, and you had cases of people coming out in support of Palestine being banned in North Indian states because it reflected a Muslim demand, it's not really a majorly salient issue in the way it might have been a few years ago, when you had more voices speaking up on behalf of minority rights and talking about India's moral values also in the world. This also has to do with India broadly getting closer with Israel politically. But that's, you know, a whole other topic, and it's going to be hard for any party to speak up too much on behalf of the Palestinians without getting accused of appeasing Indian Muslims or speaking up on behalf of terror, even as India as a formal state, including the BJP, supports a two-state solution, supports Palestinian statehood and so on. But on that short note, I think we come to an end of what's a pretty big, important discussion. I'm sure we'll be coming back to this issue in future episodes. I'm certain that this isn't the last we've discussed of the Israel-Gaza and broader questions of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in our respective elections and elsewhere, I'm sure. If you've enjoyed what you're listening to or have questions or thoughts, do subscribe, share, and write into us about what you'd like to hear, what you'd like us to be discussing. For those who are signing up for our premium edition, do stick around because we have more for you.
The Election Tricycle is a Poddo podcast hosted by Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin, and Rohan Venkat. It is series produced by Nick Hilton. Tweet us at Tricycle2024. And watch a video version of the show at cooler.news. For sales and advertising, please email nick@podopods.com. podopods.com.